Good morning, everyone. Oh, it's fitting. I'm feeling a little bit anxious. So for the past 2 months or so, I've been listening to Pema Chodron's teachings on Smile at Fear. And this is a teaching that was based on her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa's teaching. And although he died in 1987, this book, it's a library book, so it has the pink thing on it, which is called Smile at Fear, was published in 2009. And when I heard that title, Smile at Fear, it really hooked me. There was a strong feeling that these teachings might be really helpful for me. And one of the perks of working as a home care physiotherapist is that I drive a lot. So I can, and I work in, my office is in Seashelt, and I drive to Gibson's most days, which is a half-hour drive. So I can listen to CBC or music or Dharma talks. So I bought the MP3 recording of Pema Chodron's Weekend on Smile at Fear. So I've spent a lot of time recently with Pema Chodron. Fear is ubiquitous and epidemic. Ubiquitous, which is my new word of the month, is defined as seeming to be at all places at once. Fear is very pervasive and contagious. It's almost palpable. We can almost smell it. In fact, we can smell fear. I Googled it. and this is from an article from the UK Telegraph. Researchers have found that chemical signals emitted by the body in sweat when scared really can be picked up by others and can trigger fear in their brains. The discovery may help to explain why individuals with phobias, such as fear of flying, can infect others who normally exhibit no such worries. And in this study that was done in New York, they found that people who are scared give off pheromones, which are hormones that subconsciously trigger parts of the brain associated with fear. And they concluded that fear could be contagious, but it was too early to say whether the brain triggers actually resulted in people being scared. And they actually did the study where they taped absorbent pads to the armpits of 40 volunteers about to do their first ever skydive. And then they had another team that had to smell these pads and decide if they could smell the fear or not. The results indicate that there may be a hidden biological component to human social dynamics in which emotional stress is quite literally contagious. And then they go on to say it's too early to say conclusively that pheromones influence our behavior. But this is the part that really kind of amused me, but maybe I shouldn't think it's too funny. Others are concerned that studies like the New York Project, which was funded by the U.S. military's research arm, could be used to develop fear pheromones for military use. So I kind of laughed when I read it, but then the more I thought about them, I thought, uh-oh. And when I was writing this section, I had these images of herds of animals, you know, herds of cows, and that idea that when one member becomes anxious or frightened, it sort of just spreads through the rest of the herd like wildfire. And I kind of think that we're not really that different in terms of our kind of that contagious feeling of fear. Fear can be very subtle or hidden. For example, when looking to see what is underneath an emotion such as anger, even hatred, we often find fear. And this is something that I've personally noticed in myself. And I was recently listening to CBC, and a fellow was being interviewed who had been a skinhead, a neo-Nazi. And when asked what had been the cause of him becoming a skinhead, he related that he had really felt powerless, weak, and insignificant as a kid. These are fear-based emotions. He was also very angry, but I remember thinking when I was listening to him that this was an example of fear being at the basis of what became some very violent behavior. Fear and anxiety fueled the hatred he felt, and being a member of a white supremacy group gave him a feeling of power over others. So what are we afraid of? According to Thich Nhat Hanh, we are afraid of death, of separation, and we are afraid of emptiness. In Pema's teaching, she talks about how so many of us feel badly about ourselves, really badly about ourselves, inadequate, and how horrible this makes us feel. It's basically doubting ourselves and not trusting ourselves. And many, many people experience these horrible feelings. In fact, I would say that pretty much every one of us feels horrible about ourselves at some time or another. These feelings of inadequacy, shame, and feeling badly about ourselves commonly arise. And this is what Trungpa has to say about this. Ordinarily, we don't let ourselves experience ourselves fully. That is to say, we have a fear of facing ourselves. Experiencing the innermost core of their existence is embarrassing to a lot of people. Many people try to find a spiritual path where they do not have to face themselves, but where they can still liberate themselves from themselves, in fact. In truth, that is impossible. There's also quite a connection between fear and anxiety and the primitive parts of our brain. In a sense, you could say that we're hardwired for fear and anxiety. And this is a quote from Buddha's Brain, which deals with the connection between the mind and our brain. This is another book I've been reading in the past little while. And this is titled Vigilance and Anxiety. When you're awake and not doing anything in particular, the baseline resting state of your brain activates a default network, and one of its functions seems to be tracking your environment and body for possible threats. This basic awareness is often accompanied by a background feeling of anxiety that keeps you vigilant. Try walking through a store for a few minutes without the least whiff of caution, unease, or tension. It's very difficult. This makes sense because our mammalian, primate, and human ancestors were prey as well as predators. In addition, most primate social groups have been full of aggression from males and females alike. And then the hominid and then human hunter-gatherer bands of the past couple million years, violence has been a leading cause of death for men. We became anxious for a good reason. There was a lot to fear. So even after all these millions of years, we still carry around that fear and anxiety. Except now, rather than fearing becoming dinner for something or someone else, our fears and anxieties are more existential, more to do with our fear of death, rejection, being alone or excluded, fear of failure, etc. Furthermore, according to Rick Hansen, the author of Buddha's Brain, our brains have a built-in negativity bias, which was designed to help us avoid threats and unpleasant situations. Here's another excerpt from his book. And it's titled, Avoiding Involves Suffering. As you can see, your brain has a built-in negativity bias that primes you for avoidance. This bias makes you suffer in a variety of ways. For starters, it generates an unpleasant background of anxiety, which for some people can be quite intense. Anxiety also makes it harder to bring attention inward for self-awareness or contemplative practice, since the brain keeps scanning to make sure there's no problem. The negativity bias fosters or intensifies other unpleasant emotions such as anger, sorrow, depression, guilt, and shame. It highlights past losses and failures. It downplays present abilities, and it exaggerates future obstacles. Consequently, the mind continually tends to render unfair verdicts about a person's character, conduct, and possibilities. The weight of those judgments can really wear you down. This has created an internal background of anxiety more frequently and more pervasively than I think we often appreciate. And when our ancestor, e.g. cavemen, were faced with a threat, the following would happen. The brain would go on alert, the sympathetic nervous system would get activated, which resulted in stress hormones flooding through the body. And one of the results of this is when we're feeling stress, it sets us up for anger and fear. Now, this whole process that involved both the brain and the body are what helped our ancestors survive. But given the low-grade stress in modern life, which again helps to reinforce fear, anxiety, and anger. What is the cost of this? Well, one thing we should consider, particularly as meditators, is that anxiety makes it harder to focus inward for self-awareness, as the brain has that tendency to always be scanning for threats or problems. One of the five hindrances in meditation is restlessness and worry. So anxiety prevents us from being calm, which is necessary for seeing clearly and developing concentration. Like any other emotion or mind state, it's difficult not to get caught up in these emotions rather than just being present. But with fear, there is also a feeling of groundlessness, and we don't like this feeling. In fact, a lot of what we do on and off the cushion is to try and keep ground under our feet. So groundlessness is something that Pema Chodron talks about and refers to in several different teachings I've listened to. And it has a very close relationship with fear and anxiety, from that queasing feeling in our stomachs to outright terror. And you could say that groundlessness is really the same thing as emptiness. And we are afraid of emptiness. Fear can be the initial cause or motivation for some of the most painful things in the world, like fundamentalism, where you feel like you need to come up with something really solid and definite, which then helps to protect you from others who don't share your views or philosophy. Racism or bigotry. There's a term called othering, where we make distinctions of us and them based on perceived differences and or feeling threatened in some way, and then we stigmatize these others. Fear is often behind addictions, where we're trying to escape those feelings of pain, inadequacy, and a sense of lack. And feelings of fear and insecurity can escalate into war, violence, and cruelty, as we saw with the fellow who became a skinhead. These are all ways that people try and get ground under their feet or get security. And besides the fact that these things that I've just spoken of are basically unskillful and leading away from being awake, the underlying fear or lack of self-esteem are not often even on people's radar. It's often below their level of awareness. And our meditation practice of looking deeply can really help us see and acknowledge these feelings of anxiety, shame, and inadequacy and insecurity, and therefore prevent the development of things like fundamentalism, bigotry, addictions, war, and violence. According to a Time magazine article that Pema Chodron read, scientific tests have proven that we are more afraid of uncertainty than we are of physical pain. As human beings, we are subject to impermanence, emptiness, and suffering. So it's not surprising that we might often feel uncertain, anxious, fearful, even terrified. Just thinking about death can be an exercise in fearfulness, trying to wrap our heads around not existing in the way we've become accustomed to. And that impermanence thing, which means that everything changes and there's nothing that we can hold on to. Scary. There are generally two behaviors we have, according to Pema, when we feel anxious or frightened. One is speeding up, and the other is laziness. So with speeding up, we rush around, being in a big hurry, always doing something, texting, talking on the phone, starting new projects, never still or quiet. We don't stop. Our bodies are in one place and our minds are usually miles ahead in the future. Laziness is like that proverbial couch potato who just sits and watches TV or spends hours on the internet. We can't rouse ourselves to do much else. And at first blush, these two things, speeding up and laziness, appear to be opposite behaviors. But if we look closer, we see that they are both ways of avoiding and running away from fear and anxiety. And most people have a tendency towards one or the other of these. I've noticed both in myself. I do find myself rushing around in a big hurry, even when there's not a reason to be in a big hurry. But I also can spend a lot of time on my couch, reading or doing crosswords. Even when there's things that I know I need to do, like maybe preparing this talk. In the Zen group, book group that I belong to in Seychelles, we are reading and discussing Thich Nhat Hanh's No Death, No Fear. And this was something we read just in the last chapter we discussed. It's called the habit energy of running. We run during the daytime and we run during our sleep. We do not know how to stop. Our practice is full, first of all, to stop, then to relax, to calm down, and to concentrate. When we can do this, then we are in the here and now. Then we become solid. And when we are solid, we can look around. We can look deeply into the present moment. We can look deeply into our true nature, and we can discover the ultimate dimension. By looking deeply, we can see that though we are waves, we are also water. But if we have not stopped, we have not learned to concentrate, then we cannot look deeply. We will not free ourselves from fear because we will not be strong enough or stable enough to see the reality of no coming and no going. I had an interesting experience recently, right around the time I was reading that chapter, of that habit energy of running. As I mentioned earlier, I drive a lot for work. One day I found myself speeding through not one, but two school zones. Not at the same time, mind you. Once in the morning and again in the afternoon. And so I was driving past Roberts Creek Elementary School, quite a bit faster than the posted speed limit. And my mind was totally somewhere else. But there was this awareness of, at some point, of all these kids over on this, you know, in the schoolyard, and then the cars where the parents were parked, because it was around 3 o'clock. They were coming to pick up their kids. And it, suddenly there was this awareness of, okay, what am I doing? Oop, speeding through a 30 kilometer hour school zone. So I immediately slowed down, and as I did, I look over and I see this woman on the side of the road, probably one of the moms, was giving me the eye. And it was this. It was a funny thing. It was this moment of seeing that, and just this feeling of, yes, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to live like this, rushing around, always in a hurry, not being present. It was a really powerful little moment. Will it change my rushing around behavior? Likely need a lot more reminders like that one to transform my habit energy of running. So how can we work with fear? First of all, we need to develop unconditional friendship with ourselves. This unconditional friendship supports us in being willing to look at ourselves clearly and stay open to ourselves, to not shut down when things are too painful, unpleasant, or when we feel hateful towards what we see in ourselves. It's training and keeping our hearts open no matter what. The tendency, as so many of us can attest to, is that when things get unpleasant or tough, at some point we take the stick out and start beating ourselves with it. How quickly we judge ourselves when we don't measure up, or we feel like we failed, or we catch ourselves being really critical of others. We are very hard on ourselves. Developing this unconditional friendship takes openness and courage. Courage helps us to stay open to our own path and suffering as well as that of others. It requires gentleness and kindness, but it takes a lot of guts. And the gentleness part can't be emphasized enough. We have such a tendency to harden ourselves, to protect ourselves, and it's crucial to meet those rigid, hard places that we uncovered with softness and gentleness. When we have an unconditional friendship with ourselves, we develop genuineness. Genuineness is not wearing a mask or hiding. When someone is genuine, you can trust them. They're not conning themselves, so they won't con us. When we're genuine, other people can trust us. It's about being present for our life and not trying to be something or someone else that we're not. And it really helps to have a relationship with a person who is genuine, especially a teacher or mentor. Having the good fortune to spend time with a genuine person helps us to get in touch with our own genuineness. Hail Norman. Meditation practice develops genuineness. When we sit and watch what arises in our minds and bodies, the thoughts, emotions, physical and mental sensations, without pushing them away or indulging in them, we become more real, more genuine. We stop hiding. We take off our masks. This is again from Thubten Trungpa's book. And it's about trusting in our basic goodness. We are fundamentally awake. We ourselves are already good. It's not just a potential, it's more than potential. Of course, we will have hesitation again and again in believing that. You might think this goodness is just an old myth, another trick to cheer us up. But no, it is real and good. Buddha nature exists in us, and because of that, we are here. Your basic Buddha nature brought you here. We need to learn to trust in our basic goodness. We all have this. And it's the same thing as Buddha nature. We all know that we have Buddha nature intellectually, but we really need to own that and trust that. So all these qualities, unconditional friendship with ourselves, genuineness, and trust in our basic goodness, as well as gentleness and courage, are qualities that help us work with fear. Well, they help us work with everything, I think, but certainly they help us work with fear. So when we are able, now this is another, not yet. So when we are able to be present with our fear, not run away from it or protect ourselves from it, what we come into contact with is vulnerability and sadness, which is another reason that we don't want to really be present for and experience anxiety or fear. It's a kind of good news, bad news situation. The good news is you are facing your fears when you feel the shaky vulnerability and sad news. The bad news is you're facing your fears and you're now feeling a shaky vulnerability and sadness. Okay, it's not really bad news. But it is part of the process, and it's worth mentioning because there's a tendency to think that we're doing something wrong when we feel vulnerable or sad. But if you think of it as uncovering that soft, tender heart, it makes sense that we would feel this way, shaky and vulnerable. This is another quote from Chogyam Trungpa. To the degree that you're willing to face yourself and face your fear and come to know your fear so intimately, you sort of know its smell, taste, its color and texture, and you particularly begin to be very wise about knowing what it triggers in you and all the different ways that you try to run away from the feeling, the emotion, the sensation of fear. To the degree that you begin to make friends with yourself, to the degree that you can face yourself, to the degree that you begin to be kind to yourself and to the degree that you begin to trust the potential that you and all other beings have to open up, to be wakeful, to be kind, to the degree that you have that, when you turn towards your fear, move close to it, you don't right away discover courage. Instead, you discover shaky, tender vulnerability. So we need to face our fear and anxiety, feel the feelings, sensations, and emotions, and then be with that shaky, tender vulnerability and sadness. This takes courage. It is also a place of groundlessness. We've taken away our protection, and there's nothing to hang on to. Groundlessness may feel like a scary place, but we need to learn how to relax with it and be present with it. Fear of groundlessness is a fear of its own. But this is where we can access great wisdom and courage. Talking about groundlessness or emptiness reminds me of the Heart Sutra that we chant so often. It inspires us to see the inherent emptiness in everything. And yet, when we touch this emptiness or groundlessness, it may be very unsettling. But we can remind ourselves that we can do this practice in small bites. And now I'd like to share with you the practice of wind horse, or lung ta. Lung is the Tibetan word for wind, and ta is the word for horse. And it is just, it is defined as a sense of gallantry, cheerfulness, upliftedness, and gentleness. And in the Shambhala tradition where this is from, all these qualities are bundled into one state or being in the person of a warrior, a spiritual warrior. And wind horse is a way that we can rouse ourselves to face our fears and ourselves. It's likened to pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. Pema Chodron also refers to wind horse or lungta as what we can do to prevent ourselves from going down. And this is her term that describes when we're going into negativity, you know, depression, loss of heart, that feeling of not really caring. When we feel ourselves going down, we can raise our lungta. When we go down, it often begins with fear, and there is a lot of habit energy associated with it. An example of this would be being at a family gathering when a family member says something to us that we perceive as hurtful or dismissive. We immediately feel that feeling of hurt or indignation, and depending on your particular habit pattern, you may shut down, become depressed, or feel inadequate. Then the stories start. I'm too sensitive. So-and-so is a really horrible person for saying that. I'm a failure, a loser. We remember other similar occasions and rerun those and basically wallow in self-pity and then beat up on ourselves. Sound familiar? If we can be aware enough to catch ourselves before we start going down, we can prevent this cycle of events from occurring. I think of it like a fork in the road. After being provoked or triggered, we can either go down that habitual path of negativity, storylines, and beating up on ourselves, or we can raise lungta and turn in the direction of courage and of trusting in our own Buddha nature or basic goodness. When we lack confidence or feel despondent or depressed, our body reflects this. We can change our mindset and help ourselves out of this downward spiral by using the body to reflect uprightness, courage, and openness. So basically, it's a pretty simple practice. And so I'm just going to give the basic instructions for raising lungta. And generally you do this with your eyes closed, but this may not always be possible for reasons I'll explain later. So the first step is coming fully into the present moment, synchronizing body and mind, which means that your body and mind are in the same place. If you're sitting, you could think of this as taking your seat. Really being there. Be aware of what's going on in your body and mind, whether it's fear or boredom or agitation, whatever is going on. It's a good idea to use your posture to support lungta by being upright, just as we would when doing zazen. You might feel the nobility and strength of your shoulders and head. Pema feels that this is the most important step, this being in the present moment. And lungta can be generated just from the step of being in the present moment, synchronizing body of and mind. This very act of being present, as we know, has tremendous power. The second step is softening and opening your heart. You can reflect on your basic goodness or Buddha nature, which is always there. And for me, this was something I felt very healing, positive and grounding, was to really feel my basic goodness. It really works, what worked for me. Then give your heart and yourself lots of warmth and space. This is a way to develop unconditional friendship with yourself. And then the third step traditionally is just to take that, expand that sense of openness and warmth out to others. However, Pema works with this third step in a different way, and she calls it taking a leap. So after coming into the present moment, synchronizing body and mind, and softening and open the heart, you open your eyes and you take a leap. And the idea is that you go into your life or the next activity, not knowing what's going to be to happen, ready for anything. It's a little bit like cultivating a don't know mind. So the idea is that wind horse or lungta can be used when we're going down, or any situation such as before going into a meeting or before having a conversation with someone, particularly one that we're dreading. So let's say that I'm about to go into a meeting, especially one with some sense of foreboding. I can pause, take my place, feel my upright posture, feel whatever is rising my body and mind, feel my heart open and soften it, and then reach for that door handle and take a leap. Walk into the room and the meeting, ready for whatever happens. And I've been playing and practicing this raising lungta. Usually I do it at the beginning of my sitting meditation because that's sort of when I really remember it. And I've also used it, and I've actually used it when I found myself about to go down. Go down a path of negativity. And I think even the idea of learning a practice like this, one of the things that helps, it just raises general awareness. So you're suddenly aware that, oh, I'm at that fork in the road where, you know, I can either go down my usual habitual path of negativity, despondency, depression, fear of failure, etc., or just be as fully present as possible, you know, feel the feelings, whatever it is, emotions, bodily sensations, and get in touch with my heart and basic goodness, and then continue on. So I'm not an expert at raising lungta, but I've been surprised at how helpful this practice is and how simple. So I'd invite you to try this yourself, to raise lungta or wind horse, either when you're going down or when you're about to start something, a meeting, a phone call, any activity, or even at the beginning of Zazen. So just to recap the three stages, it's bringing yourself into the present moment and being aware of what's happening in your body and mind. And then the second is feeling your heart, softening and opening your heart. And then the third step is either expanding the sense of softening and opening towards others, or taking a leap into the next moment of your life with that quality of not knowing mind. You can pick whichever of these seems appropriate. And as Pema says, you can tailor these instructions to what you need or what works for you in terms of finding your place, you know, working with your heart. So I'll leave the last words to Pema Chodron on the practice of lungta. It cuts through your trips considerably. Your trips about how wrong something is or how much you want from something. Just all your hopes and fears and strong emotional reactivity about the situation. It becomes more of a journey of curiosity and learning from the whole thing that happens rather than just getting hooked and caught up by your emotional reactivity. So there's nothing that you can come up with which isn't suitable material for working with, rousing yourself, and taking a leap. Thank you for listening.